time.
So we've made a digital parenting guide. Helen, tell us a bit about why we did that and what's in it.
We have a lot of conversations with parents, both locally, but also online and in the work that we do, about how to keep children safe online. One of the biggest issues that is raised is that there's no real government consensus or classes or anywhere that you can go as a parent to really pick up this information. We do know about the NCSC and we do point that out to people, but they want a little bit more interaction, I guess, when it comes to this sort of behaviour. And they want a little bit more cooperation with their government and with their local councils. So we thought, OK, well, let's get in touch with our local councils and let's start seeing what we can do, right?
Great. We've put a document together, which is probably about 6 or 7 pages of stuff. And we put that together as a help for parents that may come along to our digital inclusion coffee morning. This one's actually a coffee evening, isn't it? It's going to be next week. And who's running that?
So that's by my local MP, which is Amanda Martin. She's for Portsmouth North. So it's really good that we've got a local MP that's really hands-on in the local area, but also on a national sort of stage as well, which is good.
Amanda's a Labour MP, that's right.
She is the Labour MP, yeah. She's a new MP, actually. She's only been in now for just over a year.
And we have actually noticed quite a lot of outreach from some of the Labour MPs around here and some attention to our kind of subjects in cybersecurity and digital rights and children's online kind of stuff, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, sitting on in the shadow position for 14 years has actually been quite beneficial. So much has happened digitally in those 14 years. And where you haven't been running government, you have the opportunity to sit down and say, well, this is a growing problem that we can see that's probably not being addressed or well known by the current government. They're a bit distracted. And I think that it's something that they really got on their radar very early and they are a bit ahead of actually at the moment.
Yeah, now it's really important, isn't it? Because what happens in the formative educational years from, you know, even from like 3-4 years old onwards, when some parents will hand their kids a digital pacifier, all the way up to 13, 14, 15 years old, has a profound effect on the personalities, the educational outcomes, it sets up kids completely. You know, if they are parented by, you know, digital devices.
Well, it's not parenting at all if you let your digital device sing to your child. And I get what you mean. It does become a pacifier. And it does terrify me where I've been out with my children and someone's gone, here's my phone, and given it to a very small child, because you're setting them up to get comfort, like a pacifier, as you said, from those digital devices. And that's not ideal. They're not actually teaching your children good things, even at a young age. It's entertainment, it's junk. But what it actually does is a lot of harm very, very early on, and a lot of data gathering that people probably are not aware of.
Okay, well, let's hold up there, because this we're going to have to start breaking this down. First of all, there is this myth that we've had for maybe 20 years, and it kind of started off, well, not when I was a kid, but certainly in the next generation, that it was great if you give kids technology because it's going to fill them up with life skills and all the things they need, hand-eye coordination and so on. There is some truth in that. There are some things that can be gained.
I can give some feedback to that. I'm a millennial. I do remember the internet briefly before the internet, but I did grow up with the devices. And the two skills that it's got me is I'm really good at shooting. Shooting, like I go out shooting guns in America like that. No, I'm really good at paintball. My hand-eye coordination is really good. Okay. And I'm very good at steering. Overall, these are the skills that I've really picked up from it, from gaming. Mm. That's the sort of skills that you're getting from it. Entertainment value, right?
Let's be realistic about that. I think that most psychologists would agree. Those are the kind of skills that you kind of pick up in a couple of days, if not a few hours. Exactly. And after that, you know, you've kind of plateaued on the achievement. Well, once you've learned how to use a mouse and how to, you know, type on a keyboard and things like that, that's kind of it. After that, and also look at the interaction modes now, which are just sort of thumbs on a touch screen. Mm. I think that argument that that there are valuable skills to be learned is a bit thin, really.
Well, they're not that valuable. That's the point I'm making, is that, you know, when I go paintballing, or when I drive my car, I can't drive my car like that on the actual road. So I have to go out and do like a track day or something. So this is all, you know, entertainment that I'd have to go out and spend more money on. Again, I've learned how to be really good to entertain myself. And this is the point I'm making, is that digital technology these days is essentially entertainment.
Yeah, amusing ourselves to death. Wow, the interaction modes, the UX modes that we see, those are changing all of the time anyway. I think we went through a period where almost no kids I ever saw used a mouse, you know. That's, you know, it's like, why have you got a mouse, granddad? You know, it's, you know, we're going to go into an era of much more things like voice control and things like that. So you really have to question that whole premise of like, well, it's good to teach kids some technology skills. So you could teach them in a week and that's it, right?
The technology skills that they need to learn, they are learning from school, probably not enough, but they are learning really good skills, learning how to code, learning how to protect themselves online. That's been ramped up quite significantly in the last few years. They do have those skills. There is a little bit of big tech coming into the education, which is a bit of a problem, where they're like, oh, let's make sure everyone can do Microsoft 365, because every workplace has that. That's not necessarily true.
Absolutely. No, don't get me started on that, right? I mean, that's a huge problem in my opinion, this whole hegemony of big tech and that conflating, you know, Microsoft Office with every other form of productivity. It's just such a two-dimensional world. Anyway, I won't get into that. What I'll say is that you mentioned digital harms and you said, well, look, there's much more harms going on. What we've done in our document is to break down those harms quite a lot, haven't we?
We have.
Let's start with the invisibility of harms. Like, why don't parents pick up, or why don't even the kids themselves realize that they are having harm done to them?
But it's secret. It's not that secret. It's in the really long terms and conditions of every application or device that you accept.
I see what you mean. Yep.
It's right at the bottom, right? It's a really long document, and you probably just accept it and you don't read it. So you're given the information, but we as people choose in a way not to engage with it. So we're unaware, generally.
Nobody reads the terms and conditions, and therein lie the harms, because it, like, all, do you remember the guy on the Fast Show? It's like, I'm gonna nick that. It's like you know, a lot of people who are villains will tell you up front that they're villains. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of part of their shtick. It's part of the confidence trick. They say, don't, I'm dodgy, mate, you can't trust me. If somebody says that to you, listen to them.
Right.
But, you know, most of the time they're signaling to you what is going to happen. But people don't read the terms and conditions, and they are full of the most egregious, horrible, borderline, I mean, we can't call it criminal, because if you're of the age of majority, and we'll come back to that in a minute, if you have capacity to sign a contract, mm-hmm. people can kind of, I mean, they can contract themselves into basically illegal situations, right? And they're full of that, and nobody reads them. So is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at, is that they are telling us, but we're not reading it. And it's not like the public are making that decision out of freedom of choice. They've used language that's designed for you not to read it. They've used language that most of the public, it's legal language, most of the public can't understand. So as they go through it, they just think, oh, I don't even know what's going on about. This seems boring. This seems like it's not really something that I can engage with. And then they kind of miss the bit right at the bottom. And you always feel that they've psychologically tested these to see how many people will click away before they get to the bad bit. And then that's the one that they go with. Because if we knew about it, we'd probably read a bit more. Like, we do read our mortgage contracts all the way through, right, before we sign it. We're forced to. So, like, why aren't we doing that with our digital technology?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good point. From a security point of view, I would call those sorts of they're based contracts are a denial of service. They're like a DDoS attack on your attention.
Exactly.
The idea is it's there to overwhelm you. And that's an interesting point you make. I think, yeah, you're right, they probably do have psychologists testing how people respond to those terms and conditions to make sure that nobody reads them. Right. And you know what? I come across some incredible tricks as well. PDFs, and you read through them, and then suddenly it's the end. And then there's like, hold on, you look at the number of pages and there's six more pages and then there's three blank pages and then there's another whole load of shit, right? I've had a couple of companies pull that on me, American companies, of course. And you think, you sneaky bastard.
Right, sneakiness. It's, you know, that's the idea, is that if you really knew what you were signing up to, if it was right at the top saying, I'm going to take all your data, feed it into my AI robot, everything that you submit to me is essentially public, you probably wouldn't want to engage with it so much.
Well, it's more than that. So let's kind of cut to the chase with that. What I'm saying is that children have no legal capacity to sign that anyway.
No.
So if you give that to a 10-year-old and say, read the terms and conditions, it doesn't matter what it says in there. They are not able to enter into a legally binding contract with that. So who is making the contract?
That's true. And a lot of people say, well, you know, 10-year-olds aren't allowed on social media. But according to most social media platforms, they can at 13. But it still applies. They can't sign the document because they're not 18.
It's a mess. It's full of contradictions. It's hypocrisy all the way down. And a lot of things that sort of stand legally only stand because they've never been robustly challenged. Now, you mentioned in the document that really it's the parent that's entering into the contract. I mean, not least of all because you're paying for it on your card, right?
Right. You're paying for it, but also it all leads back to you. It's in your name. So the mobile phone, if you've got them a mobile phone, the contract leads to your name. So if your child is doing illegal activity on that phone, guess what? The police trace it straight back to you, to the parent, because only an 18-year-old can enter into a mobile phone contract and run a mobile phone. But same applies with a lot of that online activity and a lot of those social media outlets as well. Under the age of 13, they can't even have a Meta profile. However, most children have WhatsApp and have Instagram. So they must be getting there through their parents. We now have the online safety bill. So as parents, if we want to give access to something like YouTube to our children or an Xbox, we have to go and verify that we are running the account as the adult. We are running it for our child.
So the choices that we make as adults, as parents to our children, affect their health, affect their life, affect their long-term prospects, their jobs, everything in the future. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents are doing that and not looking at the terms and conditions and not really caring and just go, oh yeah, you want a WhatsApp account or you want a Telegram account or whatever.
Yeah, they've been too many times and, you know, complained for 3 hours now every day this week. So I'm just going to lament and give it to them and just click whatever buttons I need to press as quickly as possible to stop the problem.
Okay, so what are we saying? Don't do that.
No, don't do that. Do not fall for your child's pressure, because it comes from their peers as well. Right? I kind of feel that all the parents are getting peer pressure from one child's idea at some point due to the group chat.
Yeah, there's usually one highly sociable, dominant child in every group. There's the cool kid who's the leader. It's like, right. Well, Billy's got that, and Billy's dad lets him have that.
Right. So why can't I do it? Come on. I get this every week at the moment with GTA 6, which I'm just not condoning until a much later date. That's not happening. But I get, well, everybody else plays it. I can just watch YouTube videos of it anyway. And I'm like, yeah, but you're not playing the game. But it is difficult. It can be hard.
Okay, so some of the harms are invisible because they're deliberately hidden from us. They're deliberately hidden by the lawyers that write terms and conditions. And they're deliberately hidden because parents choose not to read them. And they are harms. But let's talk about other ways that these harms are invisible.
Right.
And in our document, we said, you know, with digital harms, you can't see the cuts and bruises. There's nothing there for the parents to see. And like bad diet or smoking or exposure to asbestos or something, those harms are invisible for a long, long, long time until, you know, years down the road.
Adulthood, essentially.
Yeah, symptoms appear and then, you know, it's a bit late, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we all know some of those already as well, don't we? Because we're now getting data, again, from, unfortunately, my generation being the first ones to go online, we often hear about millennials who've got critical problems, they've got mental health issues, or addictions to video games, addictions to other things I don't really want to talk about. people are not getting jobs, they're staying in and they're just addicted to their technology. That is a real phenomenon.
Absolutely. We're all seeing it now. So we're saying that we need to prevent these harms from happening before they happen.
Mm-hmm. And that comes from laying the foundation of using technology the right way, because there are two different ways of using technology, as there is with anything else. If we look at it in the context of drinking alcohol, it becomes really obvious. If we just said to our children at 13, do you know what? Alcohol's brilliant. Here's my ID. Here's a load of money. Go out and just get used to alcohol. Do what you want with it. That's probably going to lead to some sort of alcoholism, right? However, if you restrict your children from buying alcohol underage and maybe let them have a glass of wine when they're 16 at Christmas, that is a much safer way of getting into it. And they're more likely, therefore, to understand what good alcohol consumption looks like as opposed to binge drinking. Part of our parenting as well to do that for them. So it's part of our parenting to restrict their alcohol usage and consumption with making it difficult to buy, difficult to get hold of, not buying it for them. But then we just do that with the tech, right? We just go...
It's leading by example, isn't it?
It is, and it's teaching them how to do it safely. So as parents, we need to teach our children how to do the technology in a safe environment and not use it in a dangerous way. But that doesn't help if you're addicted to it as a parent, does it?
Well, and we see that a lot of that monkey see, monkey do, that, you know, that's what children learn by imitation. And it's no good if mum is just addicted to her smartphone, constantly on it, scrolling away.
So I guess part of the project is also letting parents know, to some extent, certainly younger parents, that they might actually be victims to the same harms that we're trying to help guide them into, guide their children to avoid. And that does happen. That does happen sometimes. People go, oh my God, I'm addicted to Facebook. I
Absolutely.
Spend 9 hours a night just scrolling on it, doom scrolling. What am I doing?
We've got a new angle that we're going to be pushing on that quite soon. And Kate's going to be interviewing Aaron Balick. And he's got he likes to talk about hope scrolling. So that's just something for the future. We want to kind of reframe that away from doom scrolling to hope scrolling. It sounds great. But yeah, you're absolutely right. So some parents are worse than their kids, right? You know, and to face that is very difficult, because before you can lead by example and say to your kids, well, look, this is how you should use it, you've got to kind of look at your own behavior and go, oh my God, look at me. I'm awful. I've been on it for like 7 hours, 8 hours.
Yeah, most people don't realise things like, I've had conversations with parents where they say, what do you mean Snapchat's been sending mine and my child's location to the whole city? Well, you left the wrong setting on, and you left it on share location with all. So it's not just your contacts, it's just anyone who's got the app in your general location.
Okay. Let's break this down a bit more, because what we want to do is we want to separate technical harms from physical harms and from psychological mental harms. There are all these spheres of harm that sometimes intersect and sometimes don't, but we need to kind of be a little bit systematic and look at them separately. So let's talk about harms to the body.
Right.
We've got a section at the beginning here, the tired red eyes, staying up late on devices, right. Sore necks, bad posture, obvious circulatory problems, stomach problems.
That sounds like my whole childhood and adulthood so far. Uh-huh.
Right. You know, these are having really bad effects of people in their 20s and 30s who've kind of got the kind of symptoms that you'd expect in your 60s or 70s.
Yeah. There's ways to overcome that if you're going to sit on a computer for a long time, but you've got to do it right. And you need to know how to do it right. And you need to know what's wrong about it in the first place. And as IT workers, we all know.
That's right. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you're in the workplace, if we're doing this for a job, then the employer has to adhere to a whole load of health and safety regulations and regular breaks. But, you know, why would you allow your kids to be put into a kind of industrial injury situation and not, you know? The good news about this is that if you intervene pretty early and you say, look, you're getting too much screen time, look at the state of your neck, look at the state of your eyes, young people's bodies bounce back really quickly, right?
Yeah.
That all of that fatigue and all of that eye strain and all of that, those nervous tics and the sore necks, they disappear really quickly because, you know, young people's bodies are very robust and resilient. So it's really important, maybe, you know, to prioritize these physical harms the amount of time that kids are spending on devices, what they're using. I mean, a smartphone is massively more harmful than a tablet, which is, again, is much more harmful than the screen that you're sitting in front of, just because of the proximity of the eyes and the these high intensity blue photons, which you know, the most serious thing is possible retinal damage.
Or, yeah, just laying in bed with it propped up against your face with your neck at a funny angle. Again, if you're staring at just that small device all day, not great. But you could also, whatever they're doing on that one device, they can do on their television, they can probably do on their console, they can definitely do it on a computer. So I guess, you know, another way to combat that is to say you don't just have to sit and stare at your phone, that there are different methods and different ways to do things.
Eating with screens around, that seems to create a lot of problems, doesn't it? A lot of eating disorders and you know, kids not eating properly and ending up with stomach problems.
Yeah, a strange thing going on with Alpha Gen at the moment, where they cannot sit down on a table and have a meal without getting up about every 3 minutes. And it's so popular. Like, we've noticed it at home with our 8-year-old, and it's so popular. I'm now seeing, you know, videos, memes and comedy aimed at that, even by the generation themselves and the older section of it. And it definitely has something to do with them watching YouTube videos that are very, very short. And they're all suffering with a little bit of sort of hyperactivity.
Yeah, these very, very fast edits and extreme colour changes. And again, you've got companies there that are hiring psychology PhDs to make digital crack, to make the most addictive stuff they can. And it's banned in our house. She's not allowed anywhere near that kind of stuff. And believe it or not, that's not just YouTube. I mean, the BBC are starting to pump out that kind of stuff now. And I really wish that there was an expert group assigned to that serious psychological investigation of just how harmful that mode of media is.
Right. And it's really difficult to get them out of that. It is interesting, though, because they do hit about 11, 12, and suddenly they want to watch actual TV, and things like documentaries suddenly pop up in their mind in the news. So it is interesting to find that there is a counter to it, where the inquisitive part of us will come forward at the right age and start asking questions.
I've got a solution. This is evil. Dad does K-pop.
Oh, God, your poor kid.
Well, it's this embarrassment. It's like, okay, you love this. So, I mean, I'm ready to get into it. You know, I'll sit there, I'll sing Soda Pop. Just say, stop it. You're ruining this for me. And after that, suddenly the interest in that just goes off a cliff.
I can imagine, sorry. You're pre-teenagers, so it works at the moment. But after a while, embarrassment results in an hour-long complaining session.
Okay, let's move on to some of the psych harms, right? Let's look at, let's just do the list. So we got attention, attachment, sociability, inner life. And in the inner life's very interesting, there's reflection, executive function, self-care, care for others, loss of ambition and loss of direction. I mean, this is, it's destroying minds, this stuff, isn't it? We all know about the attention economy. The other terrifying thing right now is the attachment economy. When, you know, the house is on fire and they'd rather save their Xbox than you.
Yeah. Although my children, luckily, know it's in the cloud, so we're all good. But if the data center was on fire, they would probably, run in there and grab the server if they could.
It becomes their primary attachment figure.
Yeah, we can be. I don't know. I think we have enough varied culture in our house, and entertainment's a luxury, right? It's not bread and butter. It's a luxury. It's earned. It's like privileges in prison, I guess, to some extent here. So we don't have that attachment as much. You know, I get requests of, can we just go sit in a tent for the next 2 weeks in a field with no tech? I don't know many parents who get that request.
I think that's because you've established that foundation quite early on. You've done a lot of family things. You've made those things exciting and fun as alternatives to screen time. But for a lot of kids out there, that becomes the first attachment thing that they pattern on. And then once they want a comfort zone and they need their nunu, that's what they go back to and seek the attachment of a screen or something.
Yeah, and it gets worse when they start to get their social interaction through it. So when they go up to the sort of senior school level, all their social interactions are done online.
That needs blowing to pieces. That is one of the objectives I think that experts and teachers and politicians should have, is to destroy that. Because to me, that looks like one of the most egregious harms at all. It's the effects on sociability. And, you know, what we found with so many things in technology is this, is that they have the exact opposite effect to what it says on the tin. You know, artificial intelligence makes people less intelligent. Social media destroyed the social. It's destroyed real social bonds, you know.
But it's easy to counter, right? My dad used to tell me as a kid, get off your computer, it's sunny outside, get outside. He literally kicked me out of the house, right? Get out. I don't want you here today. Mm-hmm. I'm having a computer today. And I'm so thankful that he did it, that I now find myself doing that to two teenagers. I'm going, well, it's sunny, you're off school, why are you at home in your pyjamas? It's 1 o'clock. Get out, go on, take a ball, disappear. And they do, right. They come out and they have a great time and they come back and tell me all these wonderful adventures that they wouldn't have had I not essentially recorded my 1950s father's voice and said, right, go, park now, find some friends.
You mentioned that in the document, and it's about gratitude. And there's a very long deferred gratification in that motive to help your kids. Is that it might be 10 or 20 years down the road, but they come back to you at some point and say, Mom, you know, I know that I hated you at the time, but I'm really, really glad that you told me to get off that thing and restricted my, and I didn't turn out like a whole bunch of my other mates who are in like rehab or worse now.
Yeah, you know, and I think that if you have those conversations with your children and you highlight the behaviours of adults who I've got friends and things, they say, why are they unmarried? Why don't they have children? What happened in their life that they, you know, to a child, success looks like married and reproduction, and potentially somewhere to live. So when you see people who haven't got married or haven't reproduced or are not in a settled relationship, because they understand gay relationships as well, we've plenty in our circle. When someone's alone and they're older, they do question that. And you have to say, well, what do they spend their time doing? Oh, they just sit at home and play games. Ha, ha, ha. Or they just sit at home and watch TV. And you're like, right, how do you go out and meet people and socialise if you're doing that? You don't.
Yeah, I think the psychologists call that failure to launch. And it's a kind of arrested development.
Yeah.
Those higher order harms that I mentioned, you know, lack of care for others, loss of ambition and loss of direction, they seem really deep. And they're kind of ruining people's lives sort of 20 or 30 years into the future. It seems that like we've got a really enormous problem to try and unpick here, right?
Yeah, and we know as well from reports that it's actually affecting men more than it is women in that regard, in that sort of failure to launch.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I know we're going to... I'm really kind of looking forward to future conversations. And I said that I'm going to really kind of take the men's corner a lot more on some of this stuff, not just in countering by talking about toxic femininity as well as toxic masculinity, but looking maybe at some of the root causes of this and why guys are having a hard time talking about it. Right. Why do you think boys are having a hard time with it?
It's not even that. It's like, if we look at what's on the internet, it was made by men for men. Right. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's addictive. Right. You made a huge entertainment. They invested loads of time, loads of money, loads of energy in making these entertainments really good. And they're still predominantly aimed at men. And then we find it surprising that some men are becoming addicted to it. There's so much more involved with that. It's a lot about mental health, about how things are changing, how the workplace is changing, about masculinity. It's all written into that. But it is being negatively affected and it is becoming far more toxic as a result of digital technology.
Let's move on down our list. Talk about dependency for a little bit. It's one of the ones that everybody thinks of. They immediately talk about, oh, addiction and things like that. But dependency is really very complex, isn't it? You mentioned that it involves peer relations. It's very hard to get away from something that you've become not just addicted to it on a personal level, but it's part of a sociable co-addictive behavior. So when one tries to leave that group, the others will all try to, you know, bring them back. You see that with alcoholics and substance abuse, right?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of peer pressure to do what your friends are doing online and to socialize in that space and to be and to push boundaries. That's normal for teenagers. It's normal for children to want to push boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's just allowing them or you need to set where that boundary is as a parent and not just go, here's the entire world, here's a load of devices to access it, off you go, have fun, enjoy yourself. That's not appropriate.
How do we in society tolerate the existence of companies who set out in their design of products and hire psychology PhDs to make things addictive? In my opinion, those people should be in jail.
Well, yeah, they're using gambling techniques at this point. Techniques that the gambling industry has to warn you of. It has to give you help if it becomes addictive. It's regulated, right? That's the difference. The gambling industry uses games, it uses addictive technology to get you to gamble, but it has funding, it has restrictions. Doesn't have that yet in the digital world. And we find that so often with the problems that we see in the digital world, the law and the regulation is 30 years behind. It's just not there.
Yeah, big time. And when it comes to attachment, I don't think generally we've got an understanding of just how dangerous this is and what's going on that makes attachment different than addiction. And it's to do with this thing that AI is fake people.
Right.
And it's the big fancy word is anthropomorphization. But, you know, any program which attempts to simulate another human being or even just another sentience, it could be a kind of cartoon character or whatever, but it tries to simulate a dialogical intelligence, you can talk to it like it's another living thinking thing, that has a much more profound impact on people's behavior than a Tetris game or something that's just got bright colors and sounds, and it feeds your reward cycle on a sensory level. When you're messing with people's attachment patterns, these programs are trying to basically seduce them and trick them and lure them into essentially a relationship with it.
But we've seen that in dating applications and chat rooms and long distance relationships. Since the beginning of the internet, it opened up that door. AI is making that far, far worse. People have been making money out of lonely people online for a long time. It's a huge market. Huge market. Do they want to fix the loneliness? Of course they don't. They make money from it. It's like the gym business, right? They don't, you know, you go to the gym because you feel like unhealthy or you feel overweight, and then you come out of the gym hungry because you've worked out. And what's right there? The snack machine. And the cafe. They don't want you to lose weight. They want you to stay a good round size so that you pay for your gym membership.
Yeah, keep coming back to that treadmill and then off to the snack machine and back to the treadmill, go round and round, round the circle. Yeah.
And that's the exact same thing that we're seeing here, is it's people make money out of your problems, out of your insecurities. And this is one of them, they're making money out of your loneliness. Solving the loneliness means that you'll stop using the dating app.
It's exploiting loneliness. And so therefore there's an incentive from big tech companies to cut people off from each other. Yeah. So it's working as a pincer movement, but not even that, it's working from multiple directions. Use the communication technology to destroy the social, cut people off from each other so that they're lonely, and now give them substitute fake people to interact with.
It's a placebo for socialization need, right? It's like, it feels like your meat is filling up, but actually it's not.
And the trap, there's always a trap at the end of it. There's a sting, isn't there? That, you know, these relationships, these fake relationships lead nowhere. They're there not to just to keep you on the treadmill, but ultimately they want to extract something from you. So all of those kind of dating apps that end in, you know, that honey trap sting where, you know, the Russian bride, she needs no $2,000 to get that plane ticket to come over and see you. Social function. Kids are not able now to do these things. How to read a room, how to approach a stranger, how to start a conversation, how to end a conversation, how to manage a queue you know, just the awkwardness of standing in the line, with patience, managing boredom, or how to argue a point, how to, you know, just calmly discuss something with people.
That's just reminded me of a story from Fort Park where two gentlemen who were Gen Z tried to queue jump in front of my children, and then I was like, kids, this is a vital lesson to learn. Queue jumping is not socially acceptable. And then the guy tapped me on the shoulder and was like, all right, love, we're not trying to nick your space. You kind of cut us off there. And I was like, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to teach my children about queue jumping. And now I'm schooling two dudes who are 23 and 24 about what queue jumping is at the same time as my children. Like, how do they not know that?
There's a temptation here. To say every generation since Aristotle has had this conversation about kids don't have any manners anymore. It's very tempting to go, yeah, you know what? I'm old now, you know. But that's not what's happening, is it? There are definitely really objectively things happening to children's psychology now that we've never seen before.
No, they don't know what a queue is because they probably don't go out and actually do any queuing because everything's digital now. Like, I bet they get their shopping delivered. That's what I was thinking. I was like, I don't think knew that just taking the opportunity to step in front of somebody in a queue would be considered queue jumping. I think they thought that you'd have to have the intention to go all the way up the front or something like that. It's like, no. And you see that on the road as well. So we have lost that social ability. We're not going out enough and being around dear old matron in my village. If you queue jumped in front of her as a child, whoa, you're in trouble. We're missing that. We're missing the old lady going, come here, you.
What about conversations? Because we can call this a conversation. You say something, I say something. You say something, I say something. And it's not just because we try to be professionals. We've both done a lot of public speaking and now as a podcast, we
have a skill. We're skilled.
Yes, it's a skill. It's a learned skill, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it involves listening and thinking, holding in mind, holding the other person in mind. When all you've ever had is a device, a screen, to interact with that, how do you learn that skill?
You don't. And we see that all the time, actually, that the conversation skills are dying out, that people interrupt each other all the time. They think I'm constantly saying, if you want to stop shouting at each other your opinions and start listening to everybody, because it's only until you listen to lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds who all want to talk to you about the same subject can you actually come and make an informed decision. So many people these days just give an opinion, make a decision without any information whatsoever. It's not informed. They've not asked anybody else. And that's a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And now that they've grown up, I mean, now we've had a couple of generations of this, you see this in the boardroom, and none of this bodes very well for conflict resolution or the ability to have grown-up conversations to discuss complex issues. So it's actually starting to feed into business and politics and things where adults now who've been exposed to this through their childhood don't have those skills now.
I've been in multiple situations where there's either been a shutdown where someone just cannot have, you know, cannot deal with that conflict. They just need to leave the room. They can't deal with it at all. Or it becomes a shouting match. And you think, oh, what is going on? What's happening? How has this descended to this point? If you're a good communicator, because other companies and other issues probably don't have that. I know they don't have that. They're really good at conflict resolution. Mm. It's a case of what they, you know, who are you hiring and what has that person been engaging with through their childhood.
Yeah, and it's not a lack of intelligence, is it? Because, you know, some of these people are actually great communicators on paper, or rather typing. And if they're given the space and they're put back into the digital environment in which they've learned stuff, they seem very intelligent communicators. But when they're put into a real life social situation with face-to-face communication, it all goes to shit.
They've never done it, because the way to do any heart-to-heart or any socialisation that's negative is straight on a messenger. Like, that for the younger generations, that really is the case. It's I'd rather send a message or a voice note than actually look at you in the face and have that conversation. And that's a really big issue, I think.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay, let's move on to talk about executive function, because that's another scary one, that we're seeing harms where people who've been brought up on digital media can't plan the day, they can't tell the time on an analog clock.
my children laugh when they see clocks. So clocks have now become an old people house thing. So if you go into a house and there's a clock, then it's instantly that old people.
You know, this thing about the time, you don't see it in public places either. So one of the places I was really surprised, an airport, that's what it was, in an airport. And I looked around and there were no clocks. Not even on the departures board was there a thing that told you the time. And I think the assumption was, well, you know, everyone's got their phone with them, haven't they? So that we don't need to put clocks in this very busy travel interchange where timing is extremely important. And it was bizarre. I'm in an airport and there were no clocks.
Because, see, not everybody's got a phone. Or not everyone's battery is on. What do you do? You'd have to go and ask someone, excuse me, have you got the time? That's so frustrating.
I kind of sat there scratching my head thinking, why? There's always a reason. Is it that they don't want to take the responsibility for actually telling you what the time is? You know, if they put a clock there, then someone would complain that it was a minute slow or something.
Oh, they've got to go up and change it when it gets out of whack. Go fix the clock. That's not really the issue. But you do need that clock. We've all been in a train station and our battery's just died on our phone. Or, you know what, we just glanced up at the clock because I can't be bothered to go all the way into my bag, go get my phone, unlock it, put in the code just to potentially find out the time. What I can just look up. This is, again, I keep saying this. This is another one of these things where technology is actually the more difficult choice than just the manual old school tech.
Totally, totally. That's everywhere. Okay, let's wrap up on the harms and then let's try and talk about something positive things that we can do. I'll skip a couple of these and let's go straight to moral injury. This is one that Kate brought up, and I think this is so deep and so horrible and sad. When young people are forced to use technologies which they know have hideous moral implications, that just destroys their soul. So, you know, your teacher says to you, you have to use Microsoft. But it's in the news that, like, Microsoft are helping whoever, like, bomb children, right? And I mean, we know this because Google have never managed to keep their chief ethicists. They have fired one after another after another after another, because to be the chief ethicist of Google is an untenable job. Impossible position, right? And for all of those big tech companies, they know that they're up to their necks in evil shit. So what happens now that younger people have woken up to this, and they know that this is the kind of information that they share with each other, is, you know, Google's evil, why are you using Microsoft, that kind of thing. You know, if their school is forcing them to use it, it's like, I'm complicit, I got blood on my hands.
Yeah, but the workplace is forcing them to use it. So the school has to respond to that by teaching them the skills they're going to need as set by the workplace, which is set by government. So realistically, children have no choice but to use it, because whatever job they do, they're stuck. They have to learn whatever their bosses choose to put on the machines.
That may change. And I think one of the ways that it changed with this thing that the European Commission are looking at is that it should be illegal for the workplace to prescribe the exact tool that you have to, the exact application you have to use, but to simply define the task. So we have to edit this document. The lock-in has always come, the fact that you can't read a Microsoft Word document in any other application, or you can't write it. So these people are kind of captives within this arena of moral injury.
I see what you mean. And we've had it before where we've had to say, well, actually, no, you know, we're a Windows organisation, you can't use Apple here. And I've worked in another organisation, they say, yeah, you can totally use your Apple. We've got an engineer that knows how to do that. It depends on what skills your IT team have.
We're going to come to remedies in a minute. But on that subject, I think I'd say I would definitely encourage parents and, you know, young people that encounter this kind of thing to exercise moral resistance and to say, no, I won't use Microsoft. No, I won't use Google or whatever big tech solution is being proffered to them, or they're being pressured into using it, because that is a moral injury.
Well, they just get detentions, I think, because they'd say, well, you have to do the work on this device that your school has signed a contract with this company to provide.
That's the scandal, isn't it? The school has signed a contract. That is absolutely scandalous. And, you know, take the detention, you know, that's my advice to the kids, take the detention.
No, just do the work anyway in a different format.
Hand it in as a .txt file, and if the teacher's so dumb that they can't read a text file then.
Yeah. What do you mean you can't read the file? If you're really good at IT though, surely it's not a problem if you're doing above and beyond. That's what I said to my son when he was freaking out. He was like, oh my God, you've given me a VM. I said, the only person that's going to know you've got that is your IT guy. And if he's watching an 11-year-old run a VM, he should do nothing but give you A's. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's what's changed. I think in our generation, the teachers would go, oh my goodness, you are really smart. Yeah, just carry on, do what you're doing. Now you'll get teachers who say, I don't like a clever dick. There's nothing worse than that out of control, intelligent kid. Be dumb like all of the others.
Yeah, they'll start freaking out and they're like, oh God, if he's doing that, what else could he do? It's not the kid, we've lost the moral trust as well.
We have always had this huge dual standard, this massive hypocrisy, and it goes like this. We teach our kids that they should know about technology. We teach them BASIC, we teach them Python, we teach them how to code. It's brilliant if you can learn about technology. And then they get to 16 and they say, don't ask questions, ask ChatGPT, be stupid, don't mess with your smartphone, nobody likes a clever dick. What's going on here is that we as a society don't value technical knowledge, but we pretend that we do. And when we see it in people, we're afraid of them.
Yeah, that is true. You know, they did something that we saw as magic and it scared us, so.
What happens is that the people in charge of maintaining those systems are embarrassed at how shit they are.
Yeah, that's true. And the gaming industry itself has got that problem. It uses so many different third parties for lots of different things. And then they all want their own files stored independently that you end up with 500 systems connected to your one system. And you expect the security guy and the IT guy to keep it safe. It's not even possible, is it?
No, and it's not using this cookie cutter rubbish big tech technology. And this comes back to the point that we were talking about with the accusation against the head of M&S. And, you know, and I was defending him saying that's really not fair. In a sense, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell given the constraints that you have, which is use Microsoft. You know, it's lost from the beginning.
Yeah.
Trying to separate the baby from the bathwater with it a little bit.
I think the way to go is to create, I know it sounds crap, but a UK version of social media for 13 to 16 year olds.
To fund all alternatives. The problem is, a big problem is having a singular monolithic social media.
I know.
We want like a Facebook or a, you know, whatever.
And it'll be like parentified and the kids won't find it cool either. So it probably won't even get used.
Yeah. So you have to create an ecosystem in which young people can build social relations. And that would look like some sort of federated, you know, cell phone system. And you'd have to make it very, very easy for them to create their own. Well, you know, Tim Berners-Lee has this sort of view, a word that he uses that's helpful, which is a pod. And the idea of a pod is like basically your own VPS. It's your own right. Based on the internet. And that's rather like how the GNU social network model works.
That's how MySpace tried to go originally as well, right? You have your little area.
Yeah.
But that wasn't safe.
Well, I don't know that it was your own actual virtual machine, but yeah, that
No, but it was meant to be like your little corner of the internet. That's what it was marketed at. And I think that's why everyone went, oh, I'd like that. It's my area, my little. So actually, that is quite marketable. I think they would enjoy that.
I see what you're saying. You're talking about, yeah, the kind of cultural, how people relate to it. Yeah, as my space.
Yours. This is your corner of the internet. You can do whatever you want with it. And then other people can connect to you through it. And I think that was the original joy of social media, but now it's been taken over by advertising companies. That is where the problem starts. Facebook was great until they said, oh, we need to make money.
I'm just kind of pondering the language and what you're saying there. I think that's quite powerful because the idea of it being a piece of internet property that you own, yeah. that was always there in the idea of a website. You know, you right. had your web server, you had your website, and it was your personal thing. And yeah, MySpace was sort of a popularization of that. And Facebook really broke with that because it turned it into a single place where you go. Like the metaphor is like the town square, like a club. I say, I want to go to yeah. some trendy nightclub and be seen there. It's a yeah. place, but it's not my place. It's a place that I go to hang out. And taking that back to a social network that's built from individually owned components, it also inculcates a bit of personal responsibility, I think. It makes people think, okay, this is my little garden. I need to look after it.
Yeah, literally, MySpace, like, you put in codes and you could do all sorts of stuff, and you could change, like, if you were computer savvy, your profile was like full of pictures, music. It was like a beautiful website. You didn't have to use the tools in the box and it would show off. So yeah, there is definitely, I think maybe the youth would be into that, but it would have to be done by someone really young and someone really cool. You'd have to get in some like fresh-faced 18-year-olds and be like, make them an internet.
Got great faith. I believe that there'd be a lot of smart young kids out yeah. there that get it. And if you gave them money and help to do it, they could build that, you know.
That's interesting. So you could totally ban social media under 16. You just need to give them a social space that they control, that they can use for socialization, essentially.
Yeah. You could give. I'd say this. I'd give every kid in the country under 16 120 quid to buy the VPS hosting and a one-click package that basically sets you up with something that looks a bit like GNU Social and a basic kind of website, and that's yours.
Yeah. You know,
and then it federates itself with all of the other nodes, with the caveat that there'd have be some sort of oversight to it. There'd be some sort of parental control. There would be some sort of what we had at college, like house wardens. You know, it's moderated in a sense. You expect that to be very, very hands off. But I don't see a government wanting to put money into that if it becomes a bunch of separately encrypted enclaves.
Yeah, they're not
going to
want that.
They're not going to like it. The reason that they like Facebook, the reason that they like big tech companies, is because they act as private intelligence agencies that they don't have to pay. The users are located in just one place.
Yeah. That's what they like. That's the whole point. Yeah, I mean, the bit I was going to add is about taking your child's phone off them and going through it, because we now do that with two children and they're fine with it. Not a problem. They're not complaining. And I think if you set those boundaries initially when you give them the phone and you say, right, you can have it, however, it comes with this sideline of rules. And if you break those rules, you lose your phone. It's fine. The kids submit their phones to me. They don't have TikTok. I'm allowed to go on their social media. I can go on their WhatsApp. I can see who they're talking to, check websites. They're not allowed to delete their history. So if it's deleted, I know about that. And I think that all parents need to know how to look for things like web history and make sure there's no missing bits.
I agree with most of that. You know, there's some interesting things in the language. It's their phone. It's my phone. When I was growing up, there was the phone. A lot of countries, people are so poor that they only have one phone and they have eight kids. And they use the phone, but they all have to share it with their brothers and sisters. It's like a really Western bourgeois luxury that it's my phone.
And well, parents want to track your children individually. So it's because they go missing when they're teenagers. So they go, oh, can I go out? And you say, yeah, I'll be back at 5. And they're not back at 5. So you have to start ringing them and going, where are you?
Kate would say that that's a attachment and relation-based thing. They're not missing. They're just not in your control. And so a lot of that problem comes from the anxiety of parents.
Well, I don't know, because I feel that they message me way more than I message them. It's really rare for me to do that. I get messages every 5 minutes of all the children going, can I do this? I'm just sniffing to here. Do you want anything? Which is nice. Or, mum, can I have this? So it's easier to control. I often get messages from upstairs saying, can I have a coffee? So it is lazy kidding in a way. But I guess it does help, because it means like, yeah, we can call them. I guess when they go out on their own, it does make it easier. And that's why they have the individual phones. Just because I need to individually speak to a child, I guess.
That's all very nice. But a lot of these problems come from the concept of ease and convenience. You want ease and convenience, you get a lot of other bad things with that.
I know. Yeah. And that's definitely something that we need to talk about. And we need to go through the settings as well. So I'll probably record a little film that I can screen share with them, where I've gone through the settings I can probably film that actually quite easily. I'll go through settings on a few apps and try and do a little tiny little film that just says this is where your settings are for most things. This is how you turn off location.
Mm-hmm. I do think benevolent parental surveillance, I don't even use that word. It's just parenting, isn't it? It's digital.
It is parenting. Yeah, that's what we should use, that term. That's great.
Digital parenting, which is to, you know, maintain an interest in your kids' activities and allow them to open up their system and share it with you.
Absolutely. And don't, as a parent, you have to realize that they also have a right to privacy. And if you break that trust, they're not going to be wanting to give their phone to you and they will be hiding things. So it's a case of, yes, I look through the WhatsApp, but I don't read the messages.
Big time. Do you remember when interviewed all the kids at the skate park and she asked like a bunch of like, I don't know, sort of 12 to sort of 16 year olds hanging around the skate park. Is it okay for the government to surveil your phone? And they said, absolutely not. That's abominable. No way. And then so her follow up question was, yeah, but what about for kids? That's even worse. Oh, you want to spy on other adults? Well, okay, you know, maybe that's what adults want to do. That's their own.
Yeah, maybe they might be criminals or whatever, but kids, we're not criminals.
Exactly. And so they were outraged. The younger people are more outraged by surveillance. They just don't kind of have, they're not articulate to speak up about it. So if, you know, I absolutely agree with you, there it has to be a positive relational thing. They have to say, yeah, it's okay for you to do that. I let you in, not like you just take my phone and rummage through it like a kind of shakedown, like border control.
No, and we do it in front of the children. So they have to come in and stand with me and we go, right, let's go through the phone then, just make sure you're being good. And when things come up, and they have, so Tommy was in a weird little group for reform lovers from school and he didn't even know what reform or Nigel Farage was. But they were sending loads of racist stuff. So I had to have a conversation about race with him. He didn't even realise what it was. And then he came back the next day and went, that Nigel Farage is a twat. I was like, oh, thank God. I was so worried about your mental health, babe.
Yeah, absolutely. Nipping it in the bud.
I didn't have to read the messages. It's the group chats. And that's what I'm saying. If it's a message between them and a friend or them and a parent, don't touch it. But if it's a group chat, especially a school group chat, do just pop your head in, have a look at the flavour of messages. That's really important because there were children who were in those groups that were being bullied. My son wasn't one of them. But those children were clearly being pressured not to tell their parents. You as a parent would find that. So again, it's going to save a whole load of world of trouble for you if you're just checking it. Also, won't know if your kids are bullied. That's another thing that I found out, that my child had bullied somebody else and we had to have a conversation about that. But again, it stops all of that behavior before it becomes a problem. And it's exactly how you parent.
I agree. Absolutely.
This girl won't love you. She'll never even look at you. You don't stand a chance because you're no good. You don't have what you need to have. And for this, you suffer. Because you haven't bought our product. You just cannot ever be happy unless you buy it right now and become better. Advance to popularity. All from the comfort of your armchair. So attractive, so sublime, so subscribe. Subscribe and rate higher on our Gullible Index. With a high Gullible rating, we can sell on your personal details at a premium to other advertisers.
I'm so happy since I bought this.
Buy and subscribe today.
It took me ages to work out the age ratings the other day because the government use a different age rating for online stuff as they do for films. So they use the PEGI system for online stuff, which is American, and they use the British one for films. Okay, so Facebook are the ones that obviously said you shouldn't be using their platform until they're 13. So they rated it as PEGI 13, which is the American equivalent of an age rating of 12. And of course, when the government then went to do the online safety bill, it basically just said, yeah, 13 is a good age. It's quite difficult because realistically, I say that a 12-year-old is okay to do those things because it's the same age, it's the same year, but they turn 13. So Tommy's friends can go on it, but he can't at the moment. So it's quite difficult. So I had to then take everything that I'd rate as a 12 and say, well, actually it needs to be 13 because that's the government's new law.
I'd love to be able to have something intelligent to say about that. But rather than just jumping in like I've got an opinion, I'd say that's something that really needs expert child psychologists to sit down and think about and look at all the different... I think it's more complex. It's like game rating, isn't it? It's more complex than just film.
Way more, which is why I've given it just a loose recommended age that I would give, because that's what parents ask me all the time. Well, what age do you recommend personally? So a lot of them, I want to just raise their awareness that their kids are using Snapchat age 8 and 9, and you can literally just buy drugs from that app to your front door.
It kind of requires a really complex threat analysis, doesn't it? Because an 8 and 9 year old isn't going to buy drugs and have them delivered to their door.
No, but a 13 year old will, who still has Snapchat.
Maybe. But then also, if they were doing that, you'd catch them out because it's your house, right? And stuff being delivered. So why have you got a kilogram parcel coming to the door, Tommy?
However, I watched a thing last night about zombie knives, which they're buying online, because they are allowed to sell like ninja sword and zombie knives. It's a huge thing. They're all buying them at 14, 15 or 9, and they're sending them to their mate's house. And then the mum will get the package and say, oh, it's my child's friend. I think just saying that you can't go on those sites for now until you're 18 might be a good idea. And again, Snapchat's another one.
Maybe, but like, let's just go back to that risk analysis again. The problem there isn't that kids can order illegal things online. Parents are having things turn up at the house and not having any oversight or checking on them. If something turned up at the door, I would look at that and go, what's that? I'm going to open it for you. You know,
that's true at the moment, yeah. But when they're 15, 16 and they get packages all the time, because they do, they start ordering stuff on the internet all the time. And it's little toys and things like that. And you end up, I don't know, just trusting them after a while. But it's not just that with Snapchat. Like, the drug dealers advertise their drugs to you without any contact. So they just send them to people, you know, that you're connected to. Sometimes you're not connected to. And it's where you can get pictures from strangers that you've never met before get sent over. So a lot of sextortion and a lot of sexual crimes are actually committed through Snapchat.
That's the important part. It's how that's structured digitally and what capabilities it allows. So being able to receive pictures or advertisements from other random accounts is definitely not a good thing.
No. And Telegram, we already know, is huge in the right wing. And it's already been found to be connected to a lot of extremism, particularly political extremism. So I don't think if you're under 18, you should be really exposed to anything like that. The law definitely protects young people from that situation. And yeah, it's crawling with Reform and other right-wing activists all over it.
Okay, that's a really interesting point of view, and I'm not sure I go along with that. What I'm questioning there is rating a platform on the basis that there's a prevalence of certain kinds of people on it.
Yeah, but they've probably got the extreme left on there too. Like, it's just a hotbed of extremist material that you can't have anywhere else. So all the other platforms that have banned it or it's against their rights, you know, all the Western platforms have said, no, we don't want it there. It can go on Telegram. And that's where we get all of the illegal content that you wouldn't want your children to see. I don't want them to see dead bodies or extremist material or illegal pornography. It's all available on Telegram. It's non-tracked, non-traced, all encrypted. It's too dangerous, I think, for an under 18 to navigate. It's almost like GTA for real.
So that's your assessment of Telegram, is that it's a hotbed of illegal material?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I know people who are extremists who will tell me, but they can only talk on Telegram.
Why do you think Telegram has become this sewer of stuff that you wouldn't want your children on?
They don't have restrictions on content like Facebook, and because Facebook and all the other social media outlets are based in a Western world, they obviously have to comply to their government. Telegram doesn't have to do that. It can do whatever it wants. It doesn't have to apply for everything, and it advertises itself as a place of freedom.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you and I want to communicate peer-to-peer, we can send whatever we like to each other.
That's fine. That's still there. You know, we still have other apps that do that.
What if there's three of us?
I get that, and I know that, but we still have Signal. I'm not complaining about Signal.
Signal's end-to-end encrypted. So you have no idea what's going across on Signal, right? But you could be sending anything that you've got no idea. I mean,
no.
And I'll just make it clear, I consider that a very good thing.
It is, and I think Telegram, isn't it marketed as the same thing?
I believe that there is a good end-to-end encrypted communication service on Telegram, yeah.
Yeah,
But that's not what. But that's not your complaint, is it? Your complaint is that it's one to many, and group chats which are completely unmoderated and contain extremist material.
Yeah, anything that is basically banned on the other platform. And we all know how risky things like Facebook. We can all see content that we're disgusted with when we go on there. So you can imagine the toilet sewer that somewhere like Telegram can become. And children, unfortunately, like to be quite extreme, so they end up going down to those extreme paths very, very quickly and sharing it with their peers very quickly.
You see, I think one of the elements here is discovery. How do they discover it? Why would children not discover disgusting material on Facebook?
They do share it, but it's not as easy to find. And it's just a shock. It's the shock value that I think that I'm seeing from the teenage boys in particular. They like to shock each other. And a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing is coming from parents. It's like the vices and the sins of the parents the children are picking up on, and they're bringing that into my home and into my child's world, and it's me to him.
Are those parents on Telegram then?
Yeah. And whose child is influencing my child by sending him reform materials, because there's no way that they would go through any other platform, because it's all AI, it's fake AI, complete misinformation, crazy stuff like Keir Starmer, like with his pants down, like doing weird stuff.
Obviously your boys are not on Telegram.
No, but they're being sent that through WhatsApp as a screenshot.
Yeah, so the material's migrating from one platform to another.
Yeah.
And you can't stop that.
No, but what we can do is say, can we limit the amount of kids that are on Telegram so that they're limited to more moderated content? And I guess that's the point I'm making with the games as well, that up until a certain age, they need to be in moderated chats, moderated groups. And then when they're 13, it's like, oh, off you go.